It's a Women's T20 World Cup qualifier special here in the build-up to the tournament in Abu Dhabi. We take a look at both groups and run through the 10 teams as they battle the rain and the subsequent travel delays before they face each other. Plus, we catch up with our very own Tib Cutler travelling with Vanuatu in their historic appearance at the tournament and the buzz and perhaps misunderstanding surrounding their GoFundMe. Wherever you are and whatever you're doing, enjoy this week's pod. Welcome in again to the Emerging Cricket Podcast and hello to all of you around the world. Daniel Beswick alongside Nick Skinner again with you. Tim is not with us, but for a very good reason. He's in Abu Dhabi with the Vanuatu team for the upcoming T20 World Cup qualifier this week, and we will hear from him in a few moments' time. A few other things going on in the emerging world, and we'll probably wrap all of those events when they're finished. Things like the ACC Premier Cup, among other tours and bilateral series going on the men's side. But we're sticking with the Women's T20 World Cup qualifier here. 10 teams battling for the last T20 World Cup spots and two tickets to go to Bangladesh. We've made the point that it's probably time for the Women's T20 World Cup format to grow in size in terms of a number of teams. It's still only a 10-team tournament. And looking at, 10 teams lining up at the qualifier, you're taking 20 down to 10, albeit with 8 spots already decided. Looking at the groups, we have Scotland, Sri Lanka, Thailand, Uganda, and USA in Group A. Ireland, the Netherlands, UAE, Vanuatu, and Zimbabwe in Group B. Now, the obvious, I suppose, favourite, and we talked about this briefly last week, Sri Lanka, who have just come off an ODI series with South Africa. They managed the highest ever successful run chase in women's ODI history with a pulverizing century from Chamari Adapadu, which just happened to be the third highest one-day international score in women's ODIs of all time. And it's, with all due respect to a bunch of the teams here who will compete for these spots, again, we look at Sri Lanka as a team who are roaring favourites to win this competition. Looking over at Group B, Ireland, the Netherlands, UAE, Vanuatu, Zimbabwe, things are at least on paper a little bit more open for a top spot. Of course, you want a top two spot to reach the semi-finals, and then you play a crossover semi for that World Cup spot. The winners of the two semi-finals qualify for the T20 World Cup. But let's break this down in a moment. There has been some one-day internationals in the lead-up here with a few of these teams organising some competitive cricket in the form of a tri-series on the one-day side. We have seen rain actually be a bit of a dampener for some T20 World Cup preparation. And of course, Scotland are there, so everywhere they go, rain seems to follow them. But I suppose just looking at this sort of lead-in one-day series to begin, Papua New Guinea, Scotland and the USA. The Scotland team, the Scotland juggernaut now with Saskia Hawley in the setup. A little bit of added depth there in that Scottish team who, like a number of teams at this level, are a little bit top-heavy in terms of their individual talent and perhaps a perceived lack of depth across the actual playing group. But starting with their little one-day journey, Nick, a couple of wins over PNG and USA, and also PNG grabbing that ODI win over USA, their first in the women's ODI format too.
Yeah, it's an interesting little series, this ODI one. I mean, yeah obviously it's some kind of preparation for the T20 World Cup qualifier with USA and Scotland both involved in that tournament. But yeah, a bit strange that they're playing it in the ODI format. I guess it's so that these teams can all get a ranking, and then I don't know, maybe they've heard word that something's coming for teams, ranked to a certain point on the rankings table, so they're trying to get on the rankings table. We saw a couple of years ago, Ireland just being on the rankings table allowed them to qualify for the women's championship, which is extremely important. And we don't need to relitigate that, but it just goes to show the importance of just being on that rankings table. So maybe they've kind of got word that something's on, in the pipeline for teams with an ODI ranking. If so, I mean, yeah, we can discuss that when it happens. But yeah, good little series. Interesting to see PNG and Scotland winning pretty comfortably against the USA. The USA looked okay in their batting. And that was a point PDP made in a chat with us, that basically the USA batters, they look like they probably would prefer the 50 over format. So in a way, it's kind of a shame that they almost never play 50 over cricket, because you know some of their batters are more suited to that format. They have good techniques. They are patient. They'll wait for a bad ball to put away. Whereas in T20 cricket, you need to go a bit harder, and they sometimes struggle with that. So they showed good signs with the bat, but their bowling just didn't quite have the penetration that you want to be taking wickets, and it showed in both those games. Scotland, yeah, I mean, they look pretty good. Obviously, PNG and USA are probably among the weaker teams that they'll be coming up against. PNG not even at the tournament, obviously. So I'm not sure how much you read into it, but yeah, nice little warm up. The Bryce sisters both hit half centuries in the Saskia Hawley, as you mentioned, pretty good get for Scotland. You know, especially the batting at the top of the order there. You know, very often it is Bryce sisters or bust. So having a bit more quality with the bat at the top of the order is going to make a pretty big difference in terms of, you know, allowing them to put up more competitive scores against the better teams, because as great as the Bryce sisters are, you can't always just be relying on them, especially when you come up against stronger teams. So if they've found a bit more quality at the top with Hawley, who plays domestically in Australia for New South Wales, then I think that's a pretty big get for them. But yeah, 200 plus scores in this series, which is, you know, often in women's cricket, that's something teams struggle with getting to. So yeah, very, very impressive outing for them in the 50 over format. Abtar Maqsood, good as usual, impossible to get away. I think, I mean, the PNG bowlers were decent, but yeah, they just couldn't back it up with the bat against Scotland, although they did manage to get over the line against the USA. Yeah, so yeah, interesting little series, nice little barometer of where everyone's at. Disha Dhingra was impressive for the USA. She's one I haven't seen much of, but you know, she was pretty good at in their top order. So one to keep an eye on in the upcoming T20 qualifiers.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit more, I suppose, about USA and their squad for the T20 World Cup qualifier in a moment. But they are a very young side. Outside of, you know, Sindhu Shrihasha, who's the captain of the team, there's not a whole lot of experience there. And this is very much a squad that will develop over time. And given two or three cycles of T20 World Cup qualifying and 50 over Cricket World Cup qualifying as well, we'll see this team only get better with time. And the two defeats here, I think, don't really mean a terrible lot in the grand scheme of things. I think the lessons that they learn from a series like this are going to be hugely beneficial for them in the future. PNG were too strong in that first ODI, winning by 6 wickets. We know it's been an emotional time for them for reasons that we, you know, we made last week and the show before in the passing of former teammate and a former captain in Kaya Arua. They've carried on nicely with this particular win. Tania Rumer showing her class at number three, just an excellent stroke player, and is able to manipulate the field with a range of shots, not only on the front and back foot, but able to sweep as well and manipulate the length of opposition spin as well. Brenda Tau, who's taken the captaincy and opening the batting, didn't quite get going in that chase against the USA. Did make a start against Scotland. Yeah, looking at Scotland, as we've mentioned, you know, the Bryce sisters have led from the front, and having this extra sort of induction of Saskia Hawley and the injection of her at the top of the order, but at least on the 50 over side of things, is I think a breath of fresh air for this Scottish team, who are just trying to get to that half level above them. They've threatened and they've beaten teams that we would perceive to be, you know, slightly better than them in T20I cricket. But for them to come out and close out two pretty strong victories on the one day side shows you that there's a little bit more going for them. Again, with Hawley there, Darcy Carter is a young player who's come through and shown her quality. Having the Bryce sisters there at 3 and 4 in the one day format has been really good for them. Elsa Lister has been great in T20 cricket with the bat, and then they've got a nice collection of bowlers that, looking now towards the T20 World Cup, you could make the argument that they're in the conversation for one of the two spots for a T20 World Cup. Just to kind of finalise the 50 over side, these one day tri series are a great sort of proof of concept here for everyone in women's international cricket on the associate side, because we're trying to find a parallel to what the men's League Two is for 50 over cricket in terms of a qualification pathway on the men's side. In the, I suppose, the acceleration of T20i cricket as the global pathway vehicle, even more so arguably on the women's side than on the men's side, it's meant that there has been not a neglect of 50 over cricket, but it's been very much an ad hoc awarding of ODI status, as we've seen for a number of teams here, and then try to organise or tack on one day matches on tours of T20s rather than the other way around, where I think on the associate men's side, yes, the T20i pathway is more inclusive of all the associate members, but I think for the high-end associates who are playing a lot of one-day or list-day cricket, they very much want the 50-over cricket to be their bread and butter and to have the T20is tacked on. Looking at something like this, you know, we have heard murmurs of a League Two on the women's side. I don't know how far away that is. But just quickly before we get to the other format and T20 World Cup qualification, Nick, there's definitely scope here. You know, if these teams are able to organise this on neutral ground as well, with UAE hosting but not participating in, you know, there's every chance that you could do this with one of the three teams hosting and then other, you know, the other two teams visiting, playing a bunch of one-day international cricket on top of the T20i cricket that they'd probably have front and centre of the itinerary as well.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you mentioned the point about, you know, Women's League 2. You could expand the Women's Championship. I still think that should have been done. Yeah, there's absolutely no reason other than, you know, bean counters in the accounts department basically not wanting it to happen, because, you know, it's long overdue for women's 50 over cricket to get more of a pathway. You know, the ICC has been pretty good on the T20 side, but yeah, it really, there isn't a whole lot to write home about on the 50 over side in terms of, basically, if you're not in that women's championship, there's nothing really other than any kind of bilateral stuff you can organize, or you know, in this case, sort of tri-series. If, you know, two of the teams are there for the World Cup qualifier, but you know, good from PNG to, I guess this was a stop on the way home basically from Zimbabwe. So, you know, there is stuff you can do. You know, maybe organize a lot of cricket at sort of airline hubs that makes it easy for people to get to. You know, I guess Malaysia aren't doing a whole lot at the moment on the men's side of things, because they've been relegated out of the Challenge League system, so they'll probably have a bit more time with their grounds free. So you could probably organise a bunch of cricket there, because Kuala Lumpur's a big airline hub. Yeah, obviously UAE, the Gulf. So, you know, there's definitely stuff you could do, but it's all, as you mentioned, it's kind of a bit ad hoc in terms of who has rankings and that sort of stuff. So that's definitely an issue, and I really do hope they don't base any future structure on who has a ranking, and that there's actually a proper qualification pathway into it. That's, you know, that's all I would say on that front.
Let's take a look at the T20 World Cup qualifier now in depth. Ran through the groups to sort of begin, but just to, I suppose, reiterate them: Scotland, Sri Lanka, Thailand, Uganda, USA, Group A, Ireland, the Netherlands, UAE, Vanuatu, and Zimbabwe. It begins on the 25th of April. It's pretty jam-packed, especially across the group stage, and then the semi-finals on the 5th of May, which do decide T20 World Cup tickets. The two grounds, the Sheikh Zayed Stadium and the Tolerance Oval, both in Abu Dhabi, are the hosts here. There's a couple of warm-up matches elsewhere, but they're the two main venues. Looking at the favourites of Group A, again, Sri Lanka are a side who, you know, you could make an argument almost didn't need to be here. If, you know, in fact, if Bangladesh weren't hosting the T20 World Cup later in the year, it would have been them going through qualification and not Sri Lanka. Thailand are a team who are very much at the back end of their golden age, and we are starting to see a few younger players come through, but the bulk of the team is very much that group that came through in that T20 World Cup in 2020. There's questions on Natakin Chandam's form heading into the tournament and the likes of the rest of the team needing to step up and make runs. Scotland are a team that we've already talked at length about on the 50 over side, but again, with the all-round talents of Saskia Hawley in the mix, it gives, you know, the Scotland management team a couple more ideas into how they want to go about their business. Uganda are an interesting one. They play a lot of cricket in the Africa region. We know through Kubuka and the Pathway events that the team has been battle-hardened over the course of the last few years, and they've got a handful of players who can certainly make a difference. And then the USA, who, as discussed, are a young team, and it's probably a cycle or two too early, but there's plenty to get excited about on the USA side of things. Just looking at that group from top to bottom, Nick, what kind of stands out for you in terms of how that will potentially shake out? Sri Lanka, you would think, would top the group, and then it's almost a three-way fight for second place and a chance to take on the first place finisher in the other group.
Yeah, that's a very tough group. I mean, as you allude to, Sri Lanka, do they really deserve to be here based on current form? Probably not. I mean, yeah, Attapattu hitting that 195 not out, almost became the third woman to hit an ODI double century, but didn't quite get there. Ran out of runs basically in that run chase.
Yeah,
but it's tough being, you know, Scotland or Thailand or Uganda coming up against a red hot Sri Lanka and thinking, you know, between those three teams there's one spot, because unless something very, very surprising happens, Sri Lanka are definitely certain to make it through to the semi-finals. I mean, just reiterating your point earlier about, you know, the fact that there is only two qualifiers coming out of this. You know, you look at the quality all the way through both groups here, and you know, you think surely more than two teams can come out of these 10 to be competitive at the World Cup. Definitely. The World Cup needs to be expanded on the women's side. It's good that they're finally doing it on the men's side. Yeah, so that is a bit unfortunate that all these teams are being made to fight over such a limited number of spots. But I think it ultimately will come down to between Scotland and Thailand. Scotland, you know, we've discussed, they are pretty heavily reliant on the Bryce sisters, but they do have, yeah, a couple more names coming through. Darcy Carter, yeah, that's an interesting one. She's come through the under-19s for Scotland. She's still only 18, so you know, they've found some young talent. I think Scotland, they're perennially, you made that kind of point about a half step. They're sort of a half step ahead of a team like Uganda or, you know, in that tri-series, the USA and PNG. But they're a half step behind the likes of, you know, proper, well, I mean, they're a bit further behind Sri Lanka, but even someone like a Zimbabwe or an Ireland, they have beaten Ireland in the past, but, you know, if they play a sort of a five-match series, you'd expect Scotland to lose, you know, 3-2 or 4-1. So they're not quite there yet in terms of that next level of pushing four members regularly. I think it definitely will come down to, but, you know, Scotland and Thailand. Uganda, we love the Ugandan team. They're great to watch. They have a lot of good players. You know, players like Konsi Aweko, who's a prolific wicket taker with her leg spin, and Jenna Nembabazi has been very good as captain. I think she pulls the team together and sort of marshals them very effectively on the field. But ultimately, the Ugandan batting, I mean, if they can turn it around, fantastic. But the Ugandan batting has been too much of a weak point that I think coming up against the likes of Thailand, who are a very good bowling unit, and Scotland, who have some good bowlers as well. Obviously, Sri Lanka, yeah, we're kind of leaving them out of these discussions because we're basically assuming that they're an automatic qualifiers to the semis. Yeah, I can't see Uganda's batting really threatening against the other teams in the group. Unfortunately, as much as we like them, I think they're probably going to end up being probably fourth. I mean, who knows? Maybe even the USA can pull an upset against Uganda. But Uganda are another step behind, if you want to see it in that sense, like compared to what you're saying about Scotland. Yeah, that matchup between Scotland and Thailand, that's tough. That's going to be probably a de facto qualifier in some ways. And that's being played on the last day of the group stage. So it's sort of will be almost a de facto eliminator. The schedule is kind of a bit interesting. They play like all the matches from both groups on the same day.
Yeah.
And then there's a rest day, and then they do it again. So I'm not sure why they didn't sort of rotate between the groups. So you've always got you know, so you have two matches every day rather than four matches and then nothing, and then four matches and nothing. It seems like that would have been a better way to, you know, to get people to watch the matches. You know, something as basic as that. I don't know. They don't help themselves sometimes with these schedules. But yeah, I mean, that matchup. That's I don't know. And it's always this situation in these qualifiers because, you know, we follow these teams throughout the kind of intervening years and we've grown to really appreciate them. I'd be very upset to see Scotland or Thailand or indeed Uganda miss out, you know, because we've seen what they can do and we like the players, but yeah, it's just so tough. For Thailand, I think it will be very interesting to see how you referred to the kind of the next generation of players coming through. I've noticed they've given the vice captaincy to Pachaputawong, who has been around the team for a couple of years now, but she's still only 20. The left arm spinner, she made her debut a few years ago, but she's really become a sort of a key component of that spin flotilla that they have in the last few years, and she's really established herself. So it will be interesting to see her taking on more of responsibility even at such a young age as the vice captain, but behind Narimal Chaiwai. Chaiwai, yeah, is going to be very important for them in terms of runs because, yeah, as you allude to, if Natakan Chantam can't turn her form around, you know, they are very reliant on her at the top of the order for runs. So, you know, if she's not producing consistently, they're probably going to struggle to put up good scores. And, you know, we've seen that in a few outings for Thailand that, you know, their bowling is still very good and very difficult to get away. But the batting of late, yeah, if Chantam's not scoring runs, they're really going to struggle. You know, you would look for someone like a Onitcha Kamchompu to step up, or you know, a player like Nanapak Kontrarongkai as well, you know, wicketkeeper, you know, senior batter who has in the past been pretty reliable, but she seems like she's not producing as much of late. So yeah, hopefully she can turn that around. Yeah, the batting really is a a concern. But then, yeah, you look across to the spin contingent, obviously Nataya Buchatam leading that with her off-breaks, Sulapon Laomi, the leg spinner, Dipacha Puttawong, the left-arm finger spinner as well, another high-quality bowler. And, I mean, where does Chanita Sudarang fit into this? We talked kind of a little while ago that, you know, her role in the team is a bit undefined. She sort of floats up and down the order. I liked her playing as a finisher and she seemed to have a little bit of success in that role, but I'm not sure if she's still going to be doing that. And then her bowling, if she can get her rhythm, she will be a very important component in that bowling lineup because they don't have much in terms of seam or swing bowling and she can get it to swing a lot. But again, she seems like she's very much a rhythm player, and if she's not on, she can struggle. So, yeah, I think Chanita's one to keep an eye on. But, yeah, hopefully Narimal Chaiwai can be contributing because she's a very good batter. But, yeah, sometimes she sort of goes missing and doesn't do a whole lot. And you know, you can't really be having that from a senior player like Chaiwai, who's the captain and one of their key batters in a relatively weak batting lineup. So if Thailand are to qualify, you know, she will need to step up, especially against Scotland in that decider. Although, you know, maybe we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves. And if Scotland play poorly, they're certainly there to be picked off by Uganda. But yeah, I think it probably will come down to Scotland and Thailand in Group A.
Chantam's output with the bat is going to be crucial. Desperate to find some form. And yeah, the point of Chanita Sutiriwang, given, you know, her finding her feet again with her action and getting all of that right, will dictate. We know both Konsi Iweko of Uganda and Nataya Buchatam have taken over 100. I think Iweko might have 100 exactly, but both have passed 100 wickets in T20I cricket and both so vital in their respective team's campaigns. But you're right, it's looking like it's going to be a fight for second over there in Group A. Let's look at Group B now. Ireland, Netherlands, UAE, Vanuatu, Zimbabwe. A little bit more open in terms of both spots, unlike Group A, where we think Sri Lanka are probably going to run away and take the top spot. Ireland, you would give, I suppose, the favourites tag, given their involvement in the T20 World Cup last year. They famously took a win over Australia in a warm-up game at Stellenbosch University, I think, which is a postage stamp. But it's still an achievement for a side to beat Australia in any format, in any situation, the way that that women's juggernaut continues to roll on. You would put Ireland as favourites. The Netherlands did take a win over Scotland in that double round robin European qualifier as well. So they're a team that we think are on the move up, almost in a similar vein to their Scottish counterparts in that region. UAE are a team who have got the wood over, say, Thailand in recent competitions. So you'd put them potentially just above the Thais on paper, even though they're in different groups here. But that would mean that those three are all in the conversation to grab a top two spot. And then you've got full member Zimbabwe, who are starting to find their own feet. And again, the point that we always continue to make, and we make no apologies for it, is that Zimbabwe are a team that are almost at a disadvantage in the women's side of things in terms of where they sit in world cricket, because they don't go through the pathway events like the other associate members and actually miss out, quite frankly, on a lot of competition building cricket. And it's actually been the reason why the likes of Uganda, among others, have come through and flourished in this region. Zimbabwe shared the spoils with Papua New Guinea in their T20I series. They did eventually take that T20I series, but they did drop a game, albeit in a super over. And PNG aren't here because Vanuatu were the ones that overran them on match day one and didn't look back in that race to top spot in the East Asia Pacific qualifier. So you would put this group, I think, a little bit closer collectively on paper between, say, the what is theoretically going to be the best team in this group and the worst team in this group. Again, it's going to be tough to pick, and we'll get to, I suppose, Vanuatu are probably the fifth side on paper here, but I could still see them beating a Zimbabwe or maybe a Netherlands or UAE in particular. So this group is seemingly more open, albeit very tough, and whoever misses out here will probably count themselves a little unlucky. But what you want to be doing here in this situation in Group B is fighting for that top spot, because you would think that you don't really want to take on Sri Lanka in that crossover semi-final for a spot for the World Cup.
Yeah, that's kind of an added dimension to this, because getting into the semi-finals to run into a red-hot Sri Lanka is going to be a bit tough on whoever comes second. This is a very open group. Yeah, you would imagine Vanuatu are probably up against it just based on the quality of the opposition. I think Netherlands are probably their best shot at a victory. UAE have been, I'd say they're one of the more exciting women's teams at the moment in associate cricket. They have a lot of very young players coming through who've shown their quality. They famously lost Mahika Gore to England because she's outgrown associate cricket, I guess you could say. So, you know, a lot of quality is being produced in the UAE. I think they are capable of beating any of the teams in this group. Zimbabwe, you mentioned, coming in just a little cold. I mean, they did play that series against PNG, but yeah, kind of as you allude to, they play a bit less cricket than other kind of low-ranked teams in Africa, because the associates are often running kind of tournaments between themselves or sub-regional qualifiers and that kind of thing that Zimbabwe aren't involved in. So yeah, it is probably not the best for their cricket. I mean, obviously, you know, you look at the quality on the team sheet that Zimbabwe has, and we saw it in that series against PNG that they do just have enough quality with bat and ball. You know, obviously, players like Marianne Masonda, Modesta Mupachikwa, some familiar names. Kellison Lovu, who's come in recently. Ashley and Daraya is another one to watch out for, and another younger player who's coming into the team and sort of finding her feet at this level. Josephine Nkomo, the sort of seam bowler, opening the bowling a lot of the time. She's often been too much for associate level batters to handle. So will be interesting to see how she comes up against Ireland and then kind of more high level associates like the UAE. And I mean, Netherlands is an interesting one. I think they've sort of typically been maybe a sort of a half step behind Scotland again, on that scale that you were referring to. So they're probably a bit weaker, and definitely, they would be struggling to be coming in first in that group. I think that's not going to happen. So it's probably a sort of a three-way clash between Ireland, UAE and Zimbabwe for that sort of realistic qualification pathway, because I don't really see Netherlands or Vanuatu topping the group, even if something special can happen and they can make it out into the semifinals. But, you know, Vanuatu make it into the semifinals out of this group would be a story in itself. So, you know, we can't sort of understate how important that would be. But yeah, I think, as you allude to, Vanuatu definitely the weakest team. Crowdfunding for their own equipment, we can maybe touch on that in a minute.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. Yeah,
let's go into it. Yeah,
it's a big deal, because there was, I mean, first of all, it was great they reached their goal in all of this. In, I think it was 750,000 VATU, and I forget what that translates to in US dollars or Australian dollars, but it's an interesting one. It spread on, I suppose, a second push that they had. It'd been going for a couple of weeks, but it was a second and a third push that sort of got them over the line and got them the kind of exposure across social media, which helped them, you know, be put in front of enough eyeballs to garner the monetary amount that they were looking for. And Tim actually came out and explained what the money was for, because there was a little bit of misunderstanding for those around and spreading the news. While it was a great initiative, I think there was a little bit of confusion as to what's covered by the ICC and what's not covered by the ICC. So stop press. I actually caught up with Tim, albeit briefly, and here's what he had to say about everything going on in regards to the GoFundMe and Vanuatu's push at the Women's T20 World Cup qualifier. Tim, it's been quite an eventful couple of days in the build-up to the tournament, so I think I'm just going to let you wind up and unleash. What's going on? You finally got to Abu Dhabi after that whirlwind trip with the Dubai floods, and a bit of a buzz around social media as well with the GoFundMe that was set up.
Well, where to start, Bez? It's been a whirlwind couple of weeks, really. We're finally sitting here in Abu Dhabi and about to head out to our first practice match against Uganda, which itself has been reorganised and changed time and ground because of the weather here. You wouldn't have known that it had flooded here in the last week and caused havoc with all the planes coming in and out, but all looking well now. But it's an interesting thing when you sort of look back and think how things started that sort of get to be somewhat of a snowball. But it was Hermione and Jamal Vera, Hermione's marketing officer and events manager, when we're hosting events, and Jamal, her older brother, who's an operations manager and national team player and jack of all trades. I think it was it's an idea between both of them to try and lessen the impact or financial impact on the players, because as has always been, basically all the gear used by most of the players in Vanuatu has either been donated, and whether that's by players they've played against for those that have played overseas, or perhaps they've had bats bought for them by the clubs. You know, Hannah Darlington left one of her bats behind at the recent Indigenous tour back in May 23. That's being used by the team, or as we've talked about in the past, a great work of Peter Duffy down in Melbourne. He makes and repairs bats, and when people bring in broken bats, he gives them the option of donating it to the cause, and he repairs it back to as close to new as possible. And he's just sent another 12 over that'll be used by our national teams, or indeed the VCA has bought the gear ourselves. So we've tried to change that up this year and bring a little bit more ownership to the gear for the players, meaning that they'll have their own equipment that's suited to them and theirs, but also hopefully that equipment will last a bit longer, because it will be owned and cared for by only one person and not be just part of a more or less a club kit for those of us that have been lucky enough to grow up in places that that had club kits. So what we have done, what we did for the men back in Malaysia, and as we were doing for the women for this tour, is that we pay the players a tour bonus or a tour fee, which is, you know, more or less a salary. And that's over and above everything else that's already provided for in this tour. You know, the ICC pays for flights, accommodation, etc. We pay for all their apparel, for food outside of match day meals and the breakfast provided by the hotels, and also travel insurance as well, which is not insignificant. Travel insurance itself is about $5,000 for a team traveling from Vanuatu anywhere in the world for a cricket tour itself. So what this arrangement was arranged, what this arrangement was supposed to do was take what would be a $500 Australian dollar kit that's, well, I think in the shops would be somewhere between $1,500 and $2,000 easily. But thanks to Ferox Cricket in Melbourne, they've been able to supply gear to us at better than wholesale rates, which means that each player would only be paying $500. So that GoFundMe and also a local sort of call for donations, so people didn't have to use GoFundMe necessarily, could drop the money in, was to cover that, meaning that the amount of money that the players themselves would have paid for the gear out of their tour bonus would be covered. And on the back of great support locally from lots of different people, it wasn't necessarily one or two entities that put a huge amount in, which is really encouraging. And also the GoFundMe, which I think has, well, dozens of donations, everything from $5 to $1,000. The CEO of iComply, Rod Prestia, donated another 1,000 to the many thousands he's already donated to the VCA through the iComply partnership. So yeah, it's pretty cool to see all the positivity generated about our women being in this tournament. I guess on the flip side, it was a little bit jarring that I think a lot of people took that as an opportunity to take it as an ICC bash time. And as we all well know, of our opinions on how we think the cricket can be better run and grown and developed internationally. And, you know, despite us just coming out of more or less the Hunger Games in Malaysia, you know, we are still due to receive almost $500,000 US dollars. We're sort of like the top third of nations in terms of funding, or members, as we say, because they're all ICC members and nations themselves. But so it's just that money has to go a long way. You know, we have 20 plus staff. You know, we don't have as many professional players now, with the four offices, four and soon to be five grounds, and everything that comes with that really does add up. So it's just a matter of us being able to make every, well, US dollar that we get from the ICC stretch, and us trying to find more and more partners, be they so governmental, from the likes of Team Up through the Australian government or beyond. So yeah, I think I put that tweet out. I think I wrote it in the airport. I was in Sydney heading back to Brisbane and about to fly to Abu Dhabi, and I thought, I'm just uneasy. You know, when there are things to talk about that we could do better from a global cricket point of view, when it comes to the size of global events, a more egalitarian approach to funding, trying to fund the little guys a bit better, and trying to bring that up quicker, as opposed to having things in place that where the rich seem to get richer and the poor, I won't say get the picture, because then we'll be singing a bit of Midnight Oil. But I think that the result of this, and why we're asking for this money, and, you know, if we'd have qualified for the Challenge League, there would have been a lot of money in the pot, and maybe we would have been looking at this differently. But, you know, in some ways, maybe not. And the fact that we're trying to really bring a sense of ownership to all of our players with their gear and their kit, it's just something that's never been there in the game in Vanuatu. And it's just something that maybe so many of us that have grown up playing in the West, and places where kids have been lucky enough to have a kit of their own from when they were 6 years old, just trying to help the players actually get a better sense of, and I'm sort of quoting Chris Laffin, sort of high performance manager, of players really investing in themselves. And that goes to everything from nutrition, welfare, and, you know, general fitness, but it's also the equipment that you have. And we know how important, well, especially bats, but other equipment is. But, you know, from a bat point of view, the difference between a good bat and a bad bat, and a catch being taken inside the boundary or going for six, or making it over a fielder, or going for four rather than being pulling out for two, is one of the sort of real easy things that can be controlled, really, in the sense of the equipment that you have. So we're just hoping this is going to be a bit of a new dawn for for the type of culture that we're trying to develop within Vanuatu, and that comes from the bottom up with our New Zealand school programs and VCA Academy. So yeah, I hope that sort of answers that. I think it's great that the world's taking notice that the Vanuatu is here, and I hope that the focus pretty soon moves away from the fact that this team had to beg for money, or how other people are putting it, and that it's not sort of Cricket Australia's fault, the ICC's fault, the Vanuatu is, but the fact that this team has come to a global tournament, the lowest ranked by quite a way, and really puts a fear of God up some of the teams out there, because, you know, you and I know that the talent's definitely there. It's just a matter of putting it together. I think that our biggest challenge will be the depth of our squad and sort of greater pool of players opposed to the other teams that are here, I think is probably the biggest factor. I think our best players are up there with some of the best players that are here. It's just going to be the depth within the team. So I think it's going to be a real team effort for us to be successful here. But by no means am I not fully aware of the challenge that this is going to be. You know, Sri Lanka, who we're playing in our second trial game, we're ranked 7th in the world and just, you know, came back from South Africa after winning games down there. But I'm just excited for the whole team and everyone connected to them, because, you know, this is really the biggest sporting event that any Vanuatu team has ever qualified for. You know, they haven't got there because of their hosting or because of a golden pass or anything like that. We've got through a tough regional qualification, beating the 11th ranked team in the world. You know, we talk about Sri Lanka being 7, you know, PNG were 11, so maybe we shouldn't be that bothered. Beating them well, and also having a bit of a wobble against a team ranked 20th, and then getting through there as well. So I think there's a lot to be excited about what this team can deliver.
A big thanks to Tim there, not long after landing in Abu Dhabi, giving us that update there. What the ICC do cover for these events are basically all the travel costs and the accommodation while teams are in the hotels in this case, UAE. There's a couple of logistical things that aren't covered, stuff like travel insurance and other bits and pieces. What the fund was set up to do was to actually provide the new protective equipment, the gear, more so the batting gear. So we know that a number of these Vanuatu Women's Internationals are seasonal workers, and also work as a part of iComply, which is a partnership that's been set up. Well, iComply is the business that's working in collaboration with Cricket Vanuatu and Rod Prestia over there. It helps the athletes there for the Vanuatu team continue to train while they are on seasonal work. So there was a few sort of to's and fro's from people questioning, you know, what the ICC were doing in terms of funding for Vanuatu. The ICC give an annual funding pool to Vanuatu of around about $500,000. That's according to Tim, who, of course, we know very well here as one of the founding fathers of emerging cricket. So he came out and clarified there were a couple of barbs that were thrown from around the place criticizing the power brokers in cricket. And I think they are well warranted in the most part. But yeah, there was some clarification needed from Tim in order to kind of explain what had actually gone on and what the money was actually for. But I think one of the big problems that actually doesn't get talked about enough, and we've made, you know, a podcast for 5 years talk about the haves and the have-nots in international cricket and associate boards collectively not getting enough funding from the ICC and the disparities for how the funds are allocated. You know, we've talked about it for 5 years. But one thing that doesn't get talked about enough is the fact that if you don't self-report your numbers fairly as an associate member, you're actually doing the other associate members who are doing it fairly a disservice, because for all of your overinflation of numbers and you getting a bigger slice of the pie, it's actually putting boards who are above board and, if anything, underselling their numbers, you know, behind where they should be. Vanuatu are a team, and, you know, we've been privy to looking at some of these self-reported numbers in the past in previous funding spreadsheets. And having been to Vanuatu, having watched them qualify at the women's qualifier ahead of the tournament, having been there in other pathway events, I look at the participation numbers and I look at how many people are working or helping out as part of the Vanuatu Cricket Association. I mean, if anything, like, they are very strict on what they do in terms of self-reporting. And then you'd see other teams around, other countries around, France being the country that we're kind of implying does this, because we've seen all these explosive claims and we've yet to see a, I suppose, an explanation from France's point of view on all of this. It means that teams like Vanuatu are actually being undercut. They're annual funding, and that funding, as we know, again, to bring it back to the overarching point, the funding's not really enough to begin with. Hence, you know, why I think Jamal Vera actually started this. I think it was actually, first of all, to help fund Vanessa Vera, the 16-year-old who was the best bowler at the tournament at the East Asia Pacific qualifier last year, and they saw how successful that was. And Jamal's idea was, well, you know, with so much generosity around the cricketing community in East Asia Pacific, and indeed parts of the associate and cricketing world, you know, can we help the Nevan girls buy some new equipment? Because it was handed down, a lot of the protective equipment. Some of the players actually coughed up money, you know, from their own coffers to put together in this GoFundMe. And what the plan was going to be, according to Tim, was that their player payments that they were going to receive here at this tournament, some of that money was going to go towards the buying of the equipment. So what this does, it just boosts the players, helps the players carry on about their business, and ultimately, you would hope, perform to the best of their abilities with the best equipment that they can possibly get. Because, you know, we know it's already hard enough for a team like Vanuatu, many of them going to an event that's probably, you know, the biggest sporting event of their lives. You know, if you don't have the confidence playing in the right equipment, or if you don't have the confidence of having sort of every possible controllable be helped along by you, then, you know, you can't play to the best of your ability. So this is a fantastic initiative, first of all. And yeah, great to see that the team got their amount in the end.
Yeah, and they do have a stretch goal as well to help fund a few other things, like some physio work and various other bits and pieces. So the GoFundMe is still open. If you're listening to this and you're thinking about donating, definitely a worthy cause in the cricketing world. Yeah, I mean, as you say, there's sort of two issues here. The first, obviously, is that there's just not enough funding to associates overall. We've seen their share reduce significantly over the last, well, decade plus, really, over, you know, yeah, a couple of rights cycles. The sort of full members keep allocating more and more to themselves and less to development work. And that's a point that's been made a lot. More roughly 11% of the ICC's revenues go to associate cricket, so 90 plus members, and the other 89% go to the full members, so that's 12. So that's already kind of inequitable. And then, you know, once you look into that, the amount that certain teams get, you know, obviously India gets a huge portion of that, and, you know, do they really need it with all the money coming in from their bilateral cricket and the IPL and whatnot? That's a whole other discussion. But, you know, it would be nice to see teams like, for example, Cricket Australia looking after other teams in the Pacific, you know, something along those lines. Because don't forget, you know, when you know, a lot of these development programs and payments to associate boards were cut, part of the sort of logic was that, well, the other full members, you know, the richer full members will kind of step up and do development work on their own. And we have really not seen that happen. So, you know, if a team like Cricket Australia could, for example, you know, maybe take less of a revenue slice from the ICC and reallocate that money into sort of their backyard, you know, the East Asia Pacific region and teams like Vanuatu, I think that would be a great step. But then, yeah, as you also allude to, even within the sort of 11% that gets allocated to associates, there's a lot of problems with the numbers that are used for allocating money are often quite questionable. That France thing with the just entire leagues that they've apparently invented out of whole cloth that never happened, that's, geez, yeah, that, I mean, that's kind of a new level in terms of the fraud. But I don't know that there are many associate teams that aren't, I mean, I guess the problem is that the ICC doesn't really have the capacity to verify any of these numbers. So, you know, ultimately you are relying on the teams being honest, and when the teams are incentivized to sort of inflate the numbers, then it's very difficult to trust them. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, could you feasibly verify all of the numbers from all of the boards? Probably not, but you could at least do like a sort of a spot check and, you know, choose a few boards at random and go into their accounts in a bit more detail to keep an eye on things and you know, put a bit of a sort of a deterrence to fraudulent reporting. But yeah, geez, it's hopefully we can get into the France cricket thing in a bit more detail in a future episode, because yeah, it really is a terrible scandal. But it goes to a lot of the problems with just with associate cricket in general, in terms of both the ICC's capacity and you know, the sort of perverse incentives, and you know, and the fact that these associates are, you know, fighting each other for a very limited pot of money. It's just a bad combination. But yeah, the GoFundMe, again, donate if you can. A great initiative from Vanuatu, but yeah, very disappointing that it sort of had to come to this when, you know, it's a few thousand dollars Australian. You know, that's nothing for Cricket Australia, you know. So it is ridiculous that you have this situation where, you know, some teams don't quite have the money to properly equip themselves for a World Cup qualifier, and then other teams, this money is something that they would have lying around in the back of the couch.
Yeah, and Vanuatu have been helped along in this fund and in other endeavours through a number of sponsors that they have. But as part of the reporting, there's a non-ICC funding tab that you've basically have to declare how much money you're receiving from non-ICC sources. And that's factored in terms of the weighting of the distribution for ICC funding as well. I think, you know, for me, as someone who, you know, can personally attest as donating to this cause, there was just, you know, so many, you know, for so many reasons, you know, on a personal level, you know, how great this Vanuatu story has been. And I think, you know, as someone who's worked on East Asia Pacific events, I think East Asia Pacific are the region that needs the most help in international cricket from an ICC standpoint, because a lot of the other regions have the blessing, or I suppose the good fortune, of geography. East Asia Pacific is a huge region geographically and so difficult to traverse. You have Japan on, you know, to the north, and South Korea to the north, all the way down to Vanuatu and Fiji, Samoa, and the Cook Islands. The Cook Islands are on the other side of the international dateline, just to give you an indication of how big geographically the area is. And they have Indonesia as well, in terms of how far they go west. So it's a massive, massive region. Philippines are in the East Asia Pacific region too. At least in Asia, what they've done in times gone past, you know, you've got the eastern and western parts of that region, they're able to kind of divvy it up, and you have the Middle East who can play a lot of cricket against each other, and the travel's not too hard, and it is a travel hub. The same with the likes of, say, Malaysia, and Kuala Lumpur is a travel hub for that part of the Asia region. In Africa, you've got Kwabuka and that Eastern African kind of powder keg of cricketing talent in that region. We see the Americas have trouble in terms of traversing between, say, the Argentinas and the Brazils of the world, all the way up to Canada, Bermuda, the USA. And it's no secret that you look at the teams of this Women's T20 World Cup qualifier and you ask yourself, why are regions stronger than others? It's because it's just easy to travel and play against teams and to build that competition up. East Asia Pacific is a region that needs all the help you can get. And just to get to Dubai, you know, forget who's funding that part of this. It's bloody hard to get from Port Vila to Abu Dhabi. I think the girls are going Port Vila, Brisbane, Brisbane, Dubai, Dubai, Abu Dhabi. And not only is it, you know, a trip that probably takes, you know, probably the best part of a day and a half, if you put together all the connections and the time and yeah, and all of that. And the time difference, I think it's 7 hours time difference. So they've got to get adjusted to that. And because a team like this hasn't been able to, because if you get there early, you've got to sort of self-fund your earlier stay. I'm not entirely sure when the official dates are for when the ICC covers, say, the accommodation costs. It means that for teams like Vanuatu in times gone past, and even in this tournament, they're probably getting there a little bit later than they would like. So it takes them a little bit of time to adjust. And that's where you get the disadvantage. You know, you can, ideally, they're already there and already preparing and already playing lead-in series and tournaments and what have you. But the home field advantage doesn't just extend to, you know, the 22 yards of the pitch and the conditions and sleeping in your own bed. It's the fact that, you know, you don't have to adjust to a time zone. You've never played there before. It's not like you're another team from the Middle East playing in UAE and you have some sort of level of what you're doing. There's just so many factors and dimensions to the challenges and the hurdles that teams like Vanuatu have, and having this fund to, you know, just to give the board and the players one fewer problem to think about, you know, it makes the world of difference. And Tim, you know, we don't want to sort of blow, you know, smoke up Tim's backside, but like, he's really good at stuff like that. You know, he's canny. His team are doing a lot with what they have been given. You know, this is a team that just lost a bunch of funding because their men's team have fallen out of the 50-over Cricket World Cup pathway too. So they were sat in a room. I was talking to Jamal Vira about this while we were in Malaysia. The Vanuatu men's squad player also works at the VCA alongside Tim. And they were saying, you know, they've drawn up two budgets, whether we get through this Challenge League qualifier on the men's side or not. And, you know, ultimately they missed out. And yeah, now they're kind of living with their new situation and their new scenario, and they're carrying on. And it's great to see them, you know, pull off or to do something like this just to help their women's team move along and to represent the country to the best of their ability.
Yeah, it just really shows to such an extent, you know, the gaps between cricket. You know, cricket is a rich sport. Cricket has a lot of money, but it's just distributed in a very uneven fashion. You know, we saw this a couple of years ago with you know, Zimbabwe players having to hit social media to get shoes, and you know, and that's a full member. So, yeah, it is really incredible that we are in a situation where we have teams and players in the international game, and the ICC just isn't providing the money that is clearly available to the ICC. You know, this money is just sitting in the pockets of boards that really don't need it, like Cricket Australia and like India, who obviously, you know, from their own revenues can fund their own cricket. And yeah, it is just very frustrating that we're in this situation, but that's how it seems like it's going to be for the foreseeable future. And yeah, Tim and the Vanuatu guys have been very good at finding ways around these sort of structural obstacles. But yeah, as much as you want to praise them for finding ways around the structural obstacles, you also think, well, you know, wouldn't it be nice if we did something about the structural obstacles in the first place? So that's kind of the mentality I have when I'm donating to this GoFundMe, and that we love Vanuatu cricket, and of course we're going to do what we can to support them. But at the same time, it would be nice if I didn't have to donate to Vanuatu cricket.
Yeah. Because
they were able to fund themselves out of, you know, the ICC's ample revenues. So yeah, it is frustrating.
I suppose being sidetracked is probably not going to do it justice. We went and took a completely different tangent to the chat, but just looking at, say, Vanuatu's actual chances here, they are a team that, as we mentioned, beat PNG to be there, which is an achievement in itself, you know, to dethrone Papua New Guinea, who have had such a stranglehold in this region for a number of qualifying cycles, 50 over cricket, T20 cricket, it hasn't really mattered. For them to win on match day one of that qualifier and to just hold their nerve and get all the way through, there were a couple of nervy moments. You know, it's not as if that qualifier outside of Papua New Guinea is not difficult, because Japan are a side who pressed, and Indonesia are a team on the rise as well. Vanuatu to come out on top of that qualifier tells you that they are a side ready to compete here. And looking at the squad, yes, I think we would agree that the work of Captain Selena Solomon and Rachel Andrew, they're probably the two key players. But Vanessa Vira, who is now 17, was 16 at the qualifier, was the best bowler of the tournament with her off spin, found a nice little line and length and just stuck to it for the week and didn't get bored of what she was doing. Nasimana Navaika is another batter that I would keep an eye on if I was watching this tournament in depth. Carlo keeping behind the stumps, he's tidy. Valencia Langiatu is a name that you will see top scoring in a lot of Vanuatu scorecards going back. Vicky Mansale, part of that sort of famous cricketing and sporting family in Vanuatu. And Alvina Chilia is another player who impressed at times in that qualifier for me as well. So I look at the team and they probably aren't as top heavy as some of the other teams here are. It's just a case of, you know, can Solomon and Andrew, one of them, really have a big day out with both ball and bat and let everyone else sort of work things out around them? They do kind of go to 6 and 7 in the batting, and you can kind of look at them and think, you know, there's still the chance to up the run rate and put up some decent scores in first innings and maybe potentially chase things down. I know it's going to be a bit tricky, you know, going from, say, the synthetic pitches that they played on at the East Asia Pacific qualifier. They didn't play on the hybrid. They played on the synthetics there And these wickets we know in Abu Dhabi, relatively speaking, for a team like Vanuatu, these wickets are going to be on the slower side. So it will take a little bit of time to adjust. And the warm-up matches mean so much to them now just in order to get things right. But I don't know if it's just me believing the hype and having seen them in person and sort of knowing what they can be and what I've seen with my eyes in comparison to not being in person in, say, Africa. I've got the feeling that they could undo someone here at this tournament. I don't think it'll be Ireland, and I don't think it will be the UAE, but I don't know. I look at those other games, and I mean, one of them's got to be gettable. Zimbabwe is probably the one I reckon they've got the best chance. The Dutch too are, I feel like, on Vanuatu's best day, could steal points from a team like the Netherlands.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. They'll have to be playing at their best. And if they are playing at their best, you know, Solomon and Andrew, as you mentioned, both firing, Valente Langiatu contributing with the bat, I think they'll put up a decent score. And that's something that, you know, a lot of associates do struggle with, especially, yeah, we can maybe look at the Netherlands in a sec, but, you know, a couple of new names coming into that squad, they're pretty heavily reliant on players like your Babette Deleide, Stera Callas. So, you know, I think, personally, I think Netherlands are their best chance at a win here. But I think Alvina Chilia is definitely one to mention. I'm glad you brought her up. She's an exciting prospect for them coming through. And yeah, Vanessa Vera, another one. They have a lot of exciting young talent as well. And that's a thing that, you know, we've talked about for a number of teams here, is that there's a bit of a challenge in kind of replacing older players who've been around for a while. You know, you could make that argument about Zimbabwe, but yeah, Vanuatu do have some exciting young players coming through, as well as the senior players like, you know, your Solmans and Andrews. So I think, yeah, on the best day, if they are playing very well, they should be able to beat a team like the Netherlands. Zimbabwe, I think, maybe is a bit of a stretch. I can't imagine when they've ever played in a ground as big as Sheikh Zayed, you know, the sort of colossal cricket stadium. That'll be very interesting to see sort of how they go in that sense. Tolerance level is a bit smaller, and yeah, kind of maybe more what they're used to in terms of just an open space and kind of a more of a, I don't know if suburban ground is the right word for the UAE, because, you know, Abu Dhabi is very spread out. But yeah, I think it'll be very interesting to see them at Sheikh Zayed in Abu Dhabi. But yeah, unfortunately, I can't see them really pushing for qualification here. But you know, I think, yeah, a win is not off the table, and that would be a huge step forward for them in their cricket.
I suppose, going back to, say, perceivably what we think will happen towards the top of this table, Ireland are a team who come off T20 World Cup experience last year. They certainly have the makings, I think, of a stronger team, and a team still with young players coming through, a young side that, again, will pose probably the biggest challenge in Group A. It's important for them, I suppose, to, again, top the group. The point that we made at the start, you know, you really do want to top the group, because you would imagine that you have to try and avoid Sri Lanka in that semi-final. But, you know, outside of the likes of, say, Richardson, who's, I think, 37 and been around a long time, they are a pretty good mix of those who have been around the circuit a long time and have seen a lot. And then looking to the youth, you know, the Amy Hunters of the world, Gabby Lewis, Ola Prendergast is a player of immense quality as well. We have seen the recent retirement of Mary Waldron, one of the few, I suppose, changes in this Ireland team over the last year or so after that T20 World Cup campaign. So I think we know what we get from Ireland, and I think if they were to argue that they were the top team in this group, I don't think you can disagree with that. Whether or not they perform in UAE conditions to the best of their potential ability, it's probably not a great matchup for them, knowing that they've got to take on the hosts in this group as well, which kind of adds another dimension to Group B. But you would think that Ireland would take one of the two top spots. And then, yeah, it's a case of just trying your utmost to ensure that you finish top of the group.
Yeah, I think Ireland's one of the better teams here for sure. The thing that puts them in that category, in my opinion, is the fact that they have a pretty reliable batting order. You know, you mentioned Gabby Lewis at the top there. She's really settled into her work as kind of a senior player at the top for them. But yeah, I don't see any really weak links in this Ireland team in the same way as, you know, you look at, say, the Netherlands or Vanuatu and you think, oh, gee, who's going to be their fifth bowler? Or, you know, the batting lineup's a bit sort of top-heavy, as we discussed. Whereas, you know, Ireland really do have quality kind of all the way down the order, and they have a lot of bowling options as well. You mentioned Orla Prendergast. She's been great for them. Emma Richardson is an interesting one in that she's been around for ages, but, you know, I was surprised when I saw how old Emma Richardson was. You know, I'd known she's been around for ages. I think she's been around for almost 20 years. I'll put it that way. You know, she's played for a couple of teams in New Zealand, I think. But she kind of just goes about her business in a quiet way, you know, bowling her very tidy off spin. I think the sort of the player that she is very well suited to the tracks here in the UAE. And I think she's definitely one to keep an eye on. I know she's not a young player to watch, but she's always been very reliable for Ireland. And, you know, I like that she's sticking around, because having a few players like a Richardson in your team really does help kind of shepherd in the next generation. And I think she's done a good job in terms of, you know, providing that experience to draw on for the Irish, especially the spin lineup that they have. So I really like this Ireland squad. I think they're very very well balanced. They have a lot of quality, and I wouldn't be surprised if they make it through. They've been pretty good they've been very good at associate/associate adjacent level. I don't know what exactly you call that, because yes, Ireland are technically full members, but they sort of often are treated like associates in a lot of ways. But there's just, as you said, a mix, the classic cliche, a mix of experience and youth. They've some good players coming through. They have some senior players like Richardson. If I'm the Irish team coming into this tournament, I'm pretty hopeful that I can make it through to the, well, certainly to the semi-finals, but to that top spot and avoid the red hot Sri Lanka.
Looking to the UAE, I would put them maybe just a tad above, in I suppose a power ranking over the Dutch, primarily because the UAE have had the wood over Thailand in their regional action. This is a team that in the western part, which is kind of ironically the Middle East, but in the western sort of zone, international associate cricket, they really are the giants, and they've feasted upon their opposition in that part of the world. When they move over to the other sort of side of the Asian region, it becomes a little bit closer, but they've definitely done enough to beat the likes of Thailand and Malaysia and Hong Kong historically on the other side. Looking at this team, we know that Mahika Gore is no longer in this setup, and they've, I suppose, played on without her for quite a bit of time now already, but the likes of Captain Esha Oza and Kavisha Egadage are the big players here. They do have a little bit of bowling depth in the form of a 17-year-old Vaishnavi Mahesh is another player that I think the world will get a really good chance to support and get behind as a real player of promise in this level of the international game. They've got the runs on the board through those wins against Thailand. I'd probably put them just ahead of the Netherlands. Looking at that Netherlands squad, they did have, a couple of key performers. Iris Willing is a player that they've kind of thrown around at the top of the order. We know Robina Rijker was in the conversation for Women's Associate Cricketer of the Year last year, as well as Iris Willing. So vital with both ball and bat, the pair of them. Stera Callis, she's been in and out of the team with some county commitments and things of that nature, sort of forcing her out at certain times. This is probably the big, you know, discussion point. Who takes the second spot in this group? At home, probably gives United Arab Emirates the slight edge, and with the results against Thailand sort of in the back of my mind, over a team like the Netherlands. But they're a side that beat Scotland in European qualifying and probably pose the biggest threat to the Emiratis at home.
Yeah, I mean, you keep discounting Zimbabwe here, right? Which I think is a bit unfair.
I don't disagree. Like, I think it's just because I think I'm just so high on the other teams here that defeat to PNG as well, I think, is probably in the back of my mind.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, this is the thing that a lot of, you know, all these teams really, especially in Group B, are capable of beating each other. And, it is very tough to... I think... Netherlands, in my sort of in mental power rankings, are behind the UAE and Zimbabwe in this group. I think they don't quite have the depth of the other teams. You mentioned Robina Raka. It will be very interesting to see how she performs. Suwazirkas, who's around the team for a little bit, her sister Heather, apparently not in the squad, which is interesting. A couple of new names as well. Caroline van Kolwijk, Meryl Dekling. So a couple of players that you sort of haven't heard of, which is encouraging because, you know, it indicates that they have a level of kind of domestic quality that they're selecting from. And, you can go read Rod's piece on a new team making its way into the women's domestic setup in the Netherlands. So hopefully that means they've found a bit more depth. But I'm not convinced that the Netherlands sort of have the quality all the way through to be taking that sort of first or second slot. Whereas, the UAE, you mentioned a few names. Vaishnavi Mahesh definitely is one to keep an eye on. She, leg spinner, always nice to see that. I mean, she's played a lot of cricket for the UAE and she's still only 17. She's very, very high quality for sure. Tirtha Satish, the wicketkeeper batter. Samira Dhanadaka is another one they're all very young and they're all performing already. So, I think this UAE team has a lot more upside than, say, a Netherlands. So I would definitely be ranking them ahead of the Netherlands there. And, I think in my mind, it's a sort of a three-way clash between UAE, Zimbabwe and Ireland. Well, for who comes out into any of the slots, because it's, any of those teams can beat each other on the given day. And as you refer to, the UAE have been very good in Asia regional stuff. I guess it'll be interesting to see how they come up against teams from outside their region. You know, they played the Namibian women 6 months ago, maybe now, and the Namibians actually won that series, I think 4-2 or 4-3. It was a relatively long series, and the Namibians came out slightly ahead. So that's interesting because, you would think Zimbabwe are a bit ahead of Namibia at the African region. So, all these teams are capable of beating each other, and it just goes to show that ultimately, there should be more places at the World Cup, really, because any of these teams that we've just been talking about are capable of providing a good match and being competitive at the main event. So it is a bit of a shame that only two out of all these 10 teams that we're talking about will be there in Bangladesh come September.
It would have been interesting, had Bangladesh had to qualify for this tournament, or say the tournament was in any other place, and let's assume that by the results of the last T20 World Cup, Sri Lanka weren't here, and you had Bangladesh come in. But even still, you would still have the conversation at this qualifier and ask yourself, how many of these teams... The way I kind of always try and look at this in terms of how many teams should be at the T20 World Cup, looking at the 10 teams here, how many teams can I sit here and go, they will compete at the next level at a T20 World Cup in a group that has probably two or three winnable games in it and a couple of tough opponents? And I'll look at this cohort of 10 teams in comparison even to the last cycle, and I think I can say, with a level of certainty that this is the strongest T20 World Cup qualifier we've seen, to the point where,
for sure.
We could probably have six teams from this qualifier go to the T20 World Cup and put in a pretty good performance. Sri Lanka is an obvious one. Ireland is another obvious one. Thailand have credentials. Scotland are a team that we think could challenge. And UAE are probably the best of say, the younger generation of players coming through as a team that could potentially do the same. And then you've got, the likes of Zimbabwe and Uganda in a region where, again, a point that we absolutely hammer is that they just play a ton of cricket. And, shock, people get good when they play more and when they practice more. And you see that in Africa.
Well, yeah, that's definitely a huge part of it.
And then to finish off with this group, we'll look at Zimbabwe in a little bit more depth. You would look at Kailis Nlovu as their young sort of generational talent. For her to play a bigger role here is probably what would be the ingredient in terms of a recipe for success here. But we know that there are nailed on members of this team who play such a big role. The captain, Marianne Musonda, with the bat, I mean, make no illusions, she's going to have to step up with the bat. Same with Modesta Mpachkwa, who also keeps wicket. But, looking at the bowling attack, and Lovu and Como as well as another one, Precious Marungay, these are all players who I think have reached the point now where T20 World Cup qualification is kind of their next step in their career progress, you know, at the risk of maybe sounding a little bit bleak. You know, these are the type of players who have threatened to be really big in this kind of sphere of international cricket at this level. But the way that Zimbabwe's women's cricket, and it's probably been more as a result of things outside the players' controls than inside. We know Zimbabwe were suspended not too long ago as well, which I'm sure had a detrimental effect on Zimbabwe's development, and they're still reeling from that. And then again, the point being that, you know, these players don't really get to play in a lot of the pathway events. And we saw at the under-19 Women's T20 World Cup last year that a team like Rwanda, a team that play a lot more cricket, can overrun a side of a careless Inlovu-led Zimbabwe, you know, in terms of youth coming through. So this generation probably needs to get it right for them to, I suppose, make any headway in the next cycle or two. Obviously this cycle because they're playing in it, but in future, you know, 2 to 3 cycles down the line, this is the group that will get them there. I don't quite see this team being a group that can challenge the next level and qualify for a T20 World Cup, but I think you're probably a little bit higher on them than I am.
Yeah, I think they've got a lot of good players. Though I think your point about the next generation is a good one, and it is notable that the Kellis and Lovu aside, that Zimbabwe team that did lose in the under-19s World Cup, they looked pretty bad. You know, they lost to Rwanda, as we alluded to. They also lost to Indonesia, and Indonesia are definitely a team that we like to keep an eye on, and they're a team on the rise. But I think it's notable that Zimbabwe are not producing the level of youth talent that, you know, you would expect from a, you know, a senior full member team in the international cricketing community. And Kellis and Lovu is pretty much the only young player that they've produced in the last few years who's been able to make the transition up to senior level, and they are a slightly older team. So yes, I agree with your sort of concerns for the future in that sense, but I think the sort of the senior names that they have, you know, the Marangues, the Masondas, the Mageri Tirapanos, you know, all those kinds of players, they are good enough that they'll definitely be in the mix here for one of the slots. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if they did make it to the T20 World Cup. They do have a lot of good players. But yeah, just I think I definitely agree that, you know, looking sort of 5 years down the line, are we going to be seeing all of the same names here, but just a little bit past their prime? Because that is definitely a concern that they don't have the sort of the next level coming through. But that's a future Zimbabwe problem, not a today Zimbabwe problem. Today, I think their team is pretty good, and similar to Ireland, you know, it's pretty balanced. I would say their batting is a bit weak. Maybe they're a little spin heavy. I guess I've mostly seen their pace attack against kind of associate batters, so it's hard to judge how they'll come up against, say, an Ireland who probably are used to faster bowling a bit more than, you know, regional African teams. But they do have some good bowlers who will challenge, certainly the UAE, who's probably the nearest competition out of the associates in that group. And yeah, I guess a team like Vanuatu, who probably haven't come up against someone of the pace of, say, a Nomvelo Sibanda or a Josephine Nkomo. So, you know, how they come up in that matchup will be very interesting. But yeah, I think they're better than you're giving them credit for. I'll put it that way.
But look, that's fair enough. I mean, I might be leaning a little bit too much into what the 19s were and then looking at some of their trials and tribulations in Africa as well. But that's forgetting as well that Africa have just been overall a strong region at this level for a number of years. So maybe they find themselves in a position where they can challenge, given the battle-hardened nature, I suppose, of African cricket and when they have had the chance to play. Looking forward to Group B, on top of the action in Group A. As we mentioned, the tournament starts on the 25th of April. So by the time this episode goes to air, you can get your popcorn ready for it. We'll have a final and a winner crowned on the 7th of May. But the important part is the two semifinals. They're the two semifinal winners going on to qualify for the T20 World Cup. Quick predictions for your two qualifiers, Nick. I will confidently give Sri Lanka one spot, top spot in Group A, and then winning the semi-final in the crossover. And it's a little bit more open on the other side. I'm going to be a little bit rogue here and at the risk of maybe jumping the gun here a little bit and maybe overinflating their home field advantage. I quite like the look of and the chances of UAE maybe upsetting Ireland and maybe topping the group. And do I want to say that UAE qualify?
Ooh.
I don't know. I think I'm going to stick with Sri Lanka Ireland for now, but I am going to rue not predicting UAE as qualifiers for the T20 World Cup, I think.
I would not be surprised if UAE got over the line, but I think I would also not be surprised if Zimbabwe got over the line. So let's say Sri Lanka and Zimbabwe.
Love to hear it. Slightly different in our predictions, and people can make fun of us when none of them happen. Anyway, looking forward to it. The tournament's being streamed on ICC TV as well. Note as well that the press release said that matches will be available on demand as well. So hopefully that means that if you miss the match live, you can go back and watch the entirety yes. of it. I'm waiting to get that clarified as well. But yeah, looking forward to it. It's a tournament that I think this is probably going to be the closest T20 World Cup qualifier on the women's side we've seen in quite some time. And is hopefully scoped for the argument that the Women's T20 World Cup is due for an expansion in the number of teams, at least by two. But that's probably a conversation for another day, Nick. We've talked at length for both these groups. Glad to be joined by you again. And yeah, enjoy watching the tournament in Iceland, I suppose, or wherever you are at that stage.
Again, the time zones are pretty good, you know, going from Africa to Europe. So that works out well for me.
Thank you to all of you who have stuck around and listened to this preview. For more, log on to emergingcricket.com, and we'll have plenty of podcast coverage with some other cricket going on the men's side as well. But for now, yeah, attention is all on this women's T20 World Cup qualifier, and we can't wait for it. So enjoy watching it along with us, and let us know where you are watching it from with the hashtag ECPod. But for now, on behalf of Nick Skinner and myself, Daniel Beswick, enjoy the qualifier, and we'll talk all about it a little bit later on.